Okay, let's unpack this. We're diving into a concept that I think every single person has felt at one point or another. It's that quiet, nagging feeling that you are running someone else's life script. You know, the sense that the fundamental rules you live by, the defaults, the limitations, they weren't actually set by you.
And that feeling is precisely the subject of our deep dive today. It's so crucial to address it because what you're sensing there, that's the presence of what the sources call an invisible operating system.
An operating system.
Exactly. An OS that shapes our decisions, our aspirations, and our limits, and it does it all just below the level of conscious thought.
We're calling it societal programming. And when you look at the source material we pulled together for this deep dive, it defines this core concept so perfectly. It's the, what is it? The invisible operating system of inherited beliefs, default behaviors, and unexamined rules.
That's the one.
It's the background code running your life. And most of us, we don't even know where the uninstall button is, let alone the code editor.
That's absolutely right. And the mission today, specifically tailored for you, the listener, is not just to understand this concept academically, it's to gain conscious control.
Right. To actually do something about it.
Yes. And the source material is very clear on this point. We are not talking about some kind of shadowy conspiracy.
No.
This is the entirely natural, though highly impactful, result of social conditioning. It's just absorption from family, from school, from our culture. We absorb patterns because the human mind is designed to learn from its environment, often without ever consciously choosing those patterns.
And that's exactly what makes it so slippery. I mean, if it felt external, like someone was telling you what to do, we could easily reject it.
Of course.
But it feels deeply internal, doesn't it? You might think, well, these must be my core values, or this is just my personality. When in reality, they're often just, I don't know, cultural hand-me-downs.
Or financial anxieties you picked up at the dinner table.
Exactly. Or emotional limitations you absorbed before you could even form a complex sentence.
Precisely. And that's why we need to distinguish between you, the self-aware, intentional agent, and the script, the reactive, conditioned programming. The goal of this dive is to give you a shortcut.
A shortcut. I like that.
We want to give you the ability to quickly recognize the symptoms, to understand the mechanics of how this OS was installed during your formative years, and most importantly, equip you with the precise tools, the detection questions, to start dismantling it.
The stakes here feel incredibly high. I mean, if you don't know the code is running, you can never debug or edit it.
You can't.
If you accept the default settings as just immutable reality, your life trajectory is basically predetermined by external forces.
And that's the core of it. The programming's only real power is its invisibility. That's it.
Yeah.
So our job today is to make the unconscious conscious. We want to move these background processes right into the foreground where they can be examined, challenged, and ultimately...
rewritten.
Exactly. Rewritten.
So let's start there with detection. If this programming is invisible, how do we even spot it in the real world? You know, in our daily lives.
Mm-hmm. Well, the sources provide... 5 really specific identifiable patterns. 5 clear signs that you're following an inherited script, not a self-offered life.
And before we jump into the signs themselves, the sources talk about a defense mechanism, right?
They do. This is critical to understand. The programming doesn't just run passively, it defends itself.
How does it do that?
The material points out that these patterns are held in place by an internal firewall, a firewall built out of fear, guilt, or shame.
The big three.
The big three. This firewall is designed to discourage any deviation from the established script. It often manifests as that sudden, really uncomfortable jolt of anxiety when you even contemplate a change.
It's that voice in your head that immediately says, oh, you can't do that. Or what will people think?
You'll fail. Who do you think you are?
Right. So we're shifting here from just these vague feelings of being stuck to spotting specific, observable, and very, very uncomfortable emotional patterns that appear in real time when you try to step off the path.
Recognizing the firewall is key because the 5 signs we're about to list are really the output of that programmed defense system. They're the symptoms.
Okay, let's get into the specifics then. The first one is foundational. Your beliefs were inherited, not chosen.
This is the fundamental starting point, and it deals with the actual content of the programming. We enter the world and we begin absorbing data immediately.
Not just language and gravity.
No, not at all. We absorb attitudes, limitations, rigid frameworks for how the world works. The source notes that many of our most crucial core beliefs are simply cultural hand-me-downs.
These are the beliefs we adopted so early in life that we have long assumed they are just fundamental truths. about the world, about our own capabilities, about what is possible for someone like us.
Think about beliefs regarding wealth, for example. It's a really clear one. If you grew up hearing, oh, we can't afford nice things, or maybe all rich people are morally corrupt.
Right. Money is the root of all evil.
That's a classic one. You adopt that entire economic framework without ever questioning it. Or what about a belief about relationships? Marriage is inherently a painful struggle that must be endured.
Hmm.
This wasn't a choice you made at 30 after thoughtful consideration. It was absorbed at age 5 by just listening to the emotional tone around you.
I love the analogy this horse uses here because it makes it so physical.
Yeah.
It says, it's like wearing your grandfather's pants and wondering why they don't fit your life.
That image just connects immediately, doesn't it? It connects to that feeling of discomfort or misalignment.
Totally.
You might find yourself pursuing a career path that was considered prestigious or secure 40 years ago, maybe a traditional degree, a steady corporate ladder.
The safe path.
The safe path. But you feel stifled. Logically, it should make you happy because society or your family said this was the right fit. But it doesn't align with who you are now in this current era. The pants were designed for a different shit, a different style, a different time, a different economy.
So recognizing that this belief system is just an outdated garment, a hand-me-down, that's the first step to taking it off.
Exactly. It stops being a sacred truth and it just becomes a contextual piece of absorbed history. It's not you. It's just something you're wearing.
And that deep discomfort is the programming failing to sync with your authentic self. Which, that brings us right to the second sign. You react instead of question.
Yes. This is where the programming really trains us to operate on autopilot.
Autopilot routines or default behaviors.
They're the hallmarks of a system running silently and efficiently in the background. The brain, you have to remember, it loves efficiency. It's always looking for the path of least resistance.
So if you're programmed to run on, say, a fear of disapproval,
then your default behavior will be to seek external validation or approval before making any move, no matter how small. Is this okay? What will they think?
And if the programming dictates that change is dangerous, your default behavior is strictly staying in your lane.
Absolutely. And this manifests in a dozen small ways every single day. Automatically saying yes to commitments you dread.
Oh, yeah.
Following the same rigid morning routine, even when it doesn't serve you anymore. Or running to social media for validation the moment you feel uncertain about something.
The program is so skilled at making these reactions feel safe and necessary, isn't it?
Incredibly skilled. The key insight here is about momentum. The program is in the driver's seat the exact moment you stop questioning why you're performing that particular action or maintaining that particular limitation.
If you aren't asking, is this actually beneficial to my present self? Or is this what I truly want to spend my energy on? Then you're just running outdated code.
You are. You're conserving mental energy at the cost of conscious choice.
The moment of choice requires cognitive effort. It requires engaging the prefrontal cortex. And the programming, which is designed for that efficiency you mentioned, tries to bypass that effort entirely.
It does. Which is why interrupting the reaction with a question is the first act of defiance.
So even a small interruption can work.
Oh, absolutely. Even just a 3-second pause before automatically agreeing to a request, that can be enough to break the momentum of the conditioned reaction and allow you to insert a conscious choice.
The third sign builds strongly on that social element.
Mm-hmm.
Identity is outsourced to the crowd.
Hmm. This one defines the entire metric of success for so many people. If you calibrate your sense of value, your life direction, and your decisions based on what the group or the collective society approves of, you have fundamentally given away your internal control.
You're seeking external validation to define your internal worth.
Precisely. And in the modern world, the crowd isn't just your immediate family or your neighborhood anymore.
No, it's global. It's social media metrics. It's the prestige of a job title over the actual fulfillment of the work.
It's the purchasing trends that dictate what kind of car or house you should aspire to own.
The source material gives us another perfect navigational metaphor for this.
Yeah.
You are navigating life with a GPS instead of a compass. And a GPS is incredibly effective, right? It tells you exactly where to turn next based on all this external data traffic, the predetermined route, and it guarantees you'll reach a destination.
But, and this is the key, that destination was inputted by someone else.
Right.
A compass, on the other hand, gives you direction based on an internal constant, your true north. If you rely on the GPS of social approval, you will arrive somewhere, for sure. You'll have success in the eyes of the crowd, maybe high status or high income.
But it absolutely will not be your intended destination.
Because you never chose the address. It was chosen by the aggregated desires of the crowd you outsourced your identity to. The measure of your worth becomes the likes you receive, or the title you hold, or the jealousy you inspire, rather than the integrity of your actions.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting for me. The fourth sign. Confusing comfort with safety. This one feels so insidious, because comfort is supposed to be good, right? We all want comfort.
This taps directly into the risk aversion that's embedded deep in the operating system. The script's primary directive is often predictability and maintenance of the status quo.
Don't rock the boat.
Do not rock the boat. To deviate, to innovate, to start fresh, to pursue a risky passion is interpreted by the primitive part of the brain as dangerous.
So the system actively trains the individual to fear their own potential.
It has to.
Because realizing that potential often requires stepping outside the known comfortable boundaries, which is what triggers that emotional firewall.
Precisely. The comfort you feel in a job you hate, or a relationship that's stagnant, or a city you've outgrown, that predictability, the source calls it a cage disguised as a couch.
A cage disguised as a couch. Wow.
The couch is soft, it's familiar, it's non-threatening, it guarantees stability. But because it actively discourages movement, it prevents growth.
Can you give us a really concrete example of how this plays out?
Sure. Think of the person who stays in a high-paying but soul-crushing job for 20 years. They know the quarterly reports by heart, they know the bureaucracy, they know their exact salary trajectory. It's incredibly comfortable, both financially and predictively.
They think, I can't risk leaving this. This is safe.
Exactly. But true safety, in a developmental sense, lies in adaptation, capability, and resilience, not in stagnation. If they lose that job, they suddenly realize they have no adaptive skills. Their identity was all tied up in that title. The programming equated safety with familiarity and inertia, not with competence and flexibility.
So that comfortable couch was the cage all along.
It was. And finally, the fifth sign. You mistake the default settings for reality itself.
This one feels like the master program.
It kind of is. The world provides us, the moment we're born, with a starter pack. A starter pack of what is normal, what is expected, and what is possible.
This is the default human OS.
Right. It includes all these unspoken rules about how hard work is defined, what constitutes a healthy relationship dynamic, or what level of financial struggle is just acceptable.
And these defaults are so powerful because they are consistently reinforced by everything, by culture, by media, by our immediate environment.
Absolutely. Mm. For instance, the default setting might be, you must work 40 hours a week for 50 years, hate your job, and then maybe, if you're lucky, you can afford to enjoy retirement.
Or expressing vulnerability is a sign of weakness.
These are not cosmic laws. They are local configurations. They are cultural defaults.
What's the critical insight that the source material wants us to grasp here?
The critical insight is the often shocking realization that most people, the vast majority, never realize that these default settings are editable.
Editable.
They are not hard-coded universal laws. They are simply the initial configurations set by the environment you happen to be born into. When you mistake the default settings for objective, immutable reality, you never even look for the options menu.
And you never start the process of customizing your own life.
Never.
Recognizing these five signs, the inherited beliefs, reacting without question, the outsourced identity, confusing comfort with safety, and accepting these default settings, that's the critical diagnostic phase.
It is.
But to truly disarm the programming, we have to understand the construction blueprints. How was this entire system installed in the first place?
So let's shift our focus now to the installation process. And this is why the programming feels so fundamental. It's insidious precisely because it is installed through a natural phased process of social conditioning over time, long before we could ever apply critical thought.
It's not a single moment of indoctrination then.
No.
It's a gradual foundational buildup, much like installing the base code of an operating system on a new computer.
Exactly. And it starts incredibly early. Phase one, early childhood imprinting from ages 0 to 7. This phase lays the bedrock.
This is perhaps the most crucial phase. What is the key mechanism that makes these years so uniquely receptive to programming?
The key mechanism here relates directly to brain science. In these formative years, a child's brain operates predominantly in theta brain waves.
Okay, what does that mean in simple terms?
For context, as adults, we spend most of our waking active time in beta waves. Beta is associated with concentration, logic, critical reasoning, the analyzing mind.
And fadeaways.
Fadeaways are much, much slower. They are the brain state associated with deep relaxation, with meditation, or that, you know, that state right on the threshold between waking and sleep.
Yeah, that drifty state.
That's theta. The source material describes a child in this state as being functionally similar to hypnosis. It's a highly receptive state where the critical filtration mechanisms we develop later are essentially absent.
So an external input arrives, a parent's worried tone, a cultural rule about gender, or just an observation about class hierarchy. The young mind isn't analyzing it or challenging it.
Not at all. It's simply recording it as undeniable truth.
It's just downloading the file.
That's the distinction. The child's mind acts as a high-fidelity tape recorder. Parental beliefs, cultural norms, unspoken rules, the emotional environment, the observed interactions are all absorbed as foundational, unquestionable truths. A parent doesn't need to formally teach a two-year-old, you must fear scarcity.
No, the child just absorbs the anxiety.
The stress, the visible lack. They absorb it simply by observing the environment and the emotional responses of the adults around them.
This means those deep intrinsic fears that feel like they are part of your DNA are often just sound bites recorded during this hypnotic phase.
They are installed directly into the core belief system. They become the subconscious basis for all future decision-making and identity creation. This is why when you're trying to change a core belief about self-worth or money later in life, the resistance is immense.
Because that belief was there before conscious reasoning even developed.
Exactly. Which makes it feel intrinsically true, not learned.
Okay, so moving beyond those highly impressionable early years, we hit phase two, social conditioning. This covers roughly ages 7 to 14. If phase one installed the fundamental code, what is phase two doing?
Once the foundational beliefs are set, phase two is all about enforcing and standardizing the behavioral templates. This is the integration phase where the outside world, schools, peers, media, structured activities begins to test and enforce alignment with the wider social OS.
And the mechanism for standardization is highly systematic. It's about rewards for conformity and punishments for deviation.
It is entirely systematic. The source gives us a wonderful, very blunt analogy for this phase. It's Pavlov's bell with better PR.
Chuckles.
Okay. The conditioning here is less about deep passive absorption and more about immediate iterative behavioral correction. It's designed to make the child prioritize social harmony above authentic self-expression.
Can we detail that reward punishment loop a little more? What does that look like?
Certainly. If you express an original, potentially unconventional idea in the classroom and the teacher ignores it, or if you wear something that's outside the current peer group norm and you receive mockery or silence.
That's the punishment.
The silence or the mockery functions as the electric shock. You learn very, very quickly that originality or deviation is socially dangerous.
And conversely, if you conform to a group standard, if you laugh at the right jokes, if you strive for the culturally approved metrics, good grades, specific athletic achievements, and you receive applause or inclusion.
You're rewarded, exactly. The programming shifts from passive installation to active optimization and enforcement. The child learns to run the behaviors that support the underlying foundational beliefs they absorbed in phase one. They start prioritizing pleasing the collective and avoiding pain.
The OS learns to prioritize external approval because that leads to survival and comfort within the tribe.
That's the evolutionary driver behind it.
And then we reach phase three, identity sculpting, typically ages 14 to 21. The source suggests this is arguably the most dangerous phase of all. Why is that?
It is dangerous because this is where the person commits the critical error. They mistake the programming for their actual personality.
Ah.
Adolescence and early adulthood are times of intense identity search and definition. But if that search is built on a conditioned foundation, the resulting identity is merely a carefully curated shell based on absorbed anxieties and enforced behaviors.
The core mechanism here is internalization, then. The person, wanting desperately to understand who they are, takes all these external opinions and solidifies them as intrinsic facts about themselves.
That's exactly right. External opinions about your capabilities, your value, what level of success is achievable for someone like you, are internalized and cemented as self-evident truths. Think about a parent or a mentor who constantly told a child they were too sensitive or not cut out for management.
The individual stops viewing those inputs as just suggestions or data points from fallible external sources.
And they start treating them as unchangeable facts about their own nature.
I am bad with money.
That's an external opinion internalized as an unchangeable identity trait. I am only successful if I reach this specific academic or financial status. That's an inherited metric that becomes the sole definition of self-worth. By the end of this phase, the person is running the OS and genuinely believes the OS is them.
So the identity crisis that happens years later is often just the authentic self trying to break out of this carefully sculpted prison of external validation.
That is often exactly what it is.
And all of this layered programming, the absorbed beliefs from phase one, the reinforced behaviors from phase two, and the solidified identity from phase three, it's all held together by that system we mentioned earlier, the emotional firewall.
The core control mechanism. Yeah. That's the genius of the system's longevity. The emotions like fear, guilt, and shame are not random byproducts. They are conditioned to function like an invisible electric fence.
They're the active defense mechanism of the status quo.
Precisely.
Can we break down how each of those emotions functions as a specific kind of alarm?
We can. Let's start with fear. Fear is usually tied to loss. Fear of losing financial security, fear of losing social standing, or fear of losing the approval of family or peers. If you contemplate quitting that secure job we talked about, the fear alarm immediately triggers, often manifesting as high anxiety or even panic.
Okay. And guilt, what's its job?
Guilt is the alarm related to deviation from obligation. If you try to pursue a dream that your family considers irresponsible or selfish, the guilt alarm activates. You feel bad, not necessarily because the act itself is wrong, but because you are disappointing the source of the program. Guilt forces you back into compliance with inherited expectations.
And finally, shame, which is arguably the deepest and most painful one.
Shame is the alarm that says you are fundamentally wrong or flawed for even considering this deviation. It's far more powerful than guilt, which relates to an action. Shame relates to the self. When the firewall triggers shame, it's not just you shouldn't have done that. It's you are a bad, incompetent, or broken person.
And that emotional spike is so intensely uncomfortable.
It reliably forces a rapid return to compliance. It pushes the individual right back inside the boundaries of the established script.
So if you try to deviate from the script, if you try to start a radically different career or pursue an unapproved relationship or just question one of those hand-me-down beliefs, those alarms go off instantly.
Instantly. They're designed to be uncomfortable enough to stop the self-authored action dead in its tracks.
The firewall maintains the system's integrity by making change feel physically and emotionally dangerous, even when logically it's the most liberating path forward.
That's its function. We've spent this time identifying the symptoms and tracking the installation blueprints. Now we move to the crucial part, the toolkit for dismantling it. So the shift now is critical. We have to move from passive absorption, which is how the OS was installed, to active intentional detection. The challenge is that the system runs silently in the background.
So detection requires active self-reflection that goes beyond just casual introspection.
It has to, because casual thoughts are often just the programming talking to itself.
We need tools that don't just ask questions, but questions that specifically punch through that emotional firewall we just described. They have to bypass those conditioned responses of fear, guilt, and shame.
How do you stop the programmed alarm from silencing the genuine answer? That's the key.
And how do we do that?
The programming relies on assumptions. It assumes its beliefs are universal truth. Therefore, the source material emphasizes that the most effective detection is not gentle self-discovery, but asking sharp, targeted questions that the programming cannot answer without revealing its flawed structure.
The sources refer to these as mental crowbars.
Yes.
This imagery is so analytical, it reminds us this isn't gentle work. It takes intentional effort to pry these assumptions open. We're using force and precision.
They are precision instruments. They're designed to bypass the emotional alarms and force the mind to confront contradictions. They work because the programmed response is often illogical or outdated or tied to someone else's historical limitation.
So asking a logical present-day question about an emotional, historically absorbed belief creates a conflict.
An unresolvable conflict, which forces the programming to expose itself.
Okay, let's break down the first of these five precision questions. This one is all about tracing the source. The question is, where did this belief originally come from?
The specific purpose of this question is to force a distinction between two very different types of beliefs. When you ask this, you are forcing your mind to differentiate between what was consciously chosen, a belief you adopted after rational consideration as an adult, and what was simply absorbed from the environment during those impressionable, filterless theta brainwave years.
Let's use a detailed example for this one. Say a listener has a deep-seated belief that they should never, ever take on debt, not even prudent, growth-oriented debt like a mortgage, or a business loan. They're running this rule rigidly.
So they apply the crowbar question. Where did this originally come from? They might have to sit with it for a while, but then they might realize that this rigid rule came from their grandmother.
Who lived through the Great Depression.
Exactly. And viewed any form of debt as a catastrophic moral failure.
Hmm.
That financial anxiety was absorbed directly. The moment they realize the source is an economic framework from 1935 tied to their grandmother's trauma, that belief immediately loses its sacred authority.
Because I see that the source material isn't a fundamental truth about modern reality or my own capability. It's just a historical anecdote. It's a contextual fear.
Precisely. By tracing the lineage, you remove the sacred authority of the belief. It transforms from an inherent universal truth into a contextual piece of absorbed data tied to a specific time, place, and usually someone else's limitations. It is the first step in objectifying the programming, allowing you to say, this isn't mine, I can return it.
The second question is about isolating authenticity. If no one judged me, what would I choose instead?
This is a direct bypass of the social calibration system we talked about earlier, the GPS navigation and the outsourced identity.
It just sidesteps it.
It does. The programming relies heavily on the conditioned desire for social approval, which is what activates the firewall's fear of judgment. This question temporarily disables that firewall.
By creating a hypothetical space where judgment is absent, where the financial, social, or familial consequences of deviation are removed, you're revealing the true, unconditioned motivation beneath the surface.
Absolutely. Think about a person who is relentlessly pursuing a career in, say, corporate law because it carries high prestige, high income, and high parental approval.
Okay.
If they really truly ask themselves this question, the answer might be, if I knew my parents would cheer for me regardless and my friends wouldn't mock me for the pay cut, I would choose to be a high school history teacher.
That is a radical shift in choice.
It is. And the distance between what you would choose without judgment and what you are choosing now is the exact measure of the programming's current influence over your autonomy.
Wow. This question reveals your authentic preference. If the only reason you are pursuing a specific path, a job, a hobby, a style, is to receive applause or avoid silence, you know that choice is being made by the crowd, not by your core self.
It forces you to confront the cost of living a validated life versus an authentic life.
The third question tests the very function of our routines, testing utility versus comfort. The question is, does this behavior move my life forward, or does it just feel familiar?
This directly challenges the cage disguised as a couch. The programming has trained us to equate the familiar with the safe and the good. We run comfortable habits not because they are effective, but because they require no internal debate and trigger no alarms.
But familiarity can be so detrimental if the habit is stagnant or limiting.
It can be a trap.
I see this manifesting most often in time-wasting behaviors that feel comfortable. For example, scrolling social media endlessly after work, or engaging in the same circular arguments with a partner. They feel familiar, but they consume energy without yielding any progress.
Precisely. We are distinguishing between actions that are truly useful, goal-oriented, and productive, that's utility, and those that are merely comfortable habits rooted in past conditioning, that's familiarity.
If you find yourself repeatedly engaging in a behavior that provides zero forward momentum, but it feels deeply comfortable,
you know you are running old code. It's the path of least resistance leading to the destination of stagnation.
This question forces a really brutal audit of your actions based on present-day utility, not historical comfort levels.
It has to be brutal.
If a routine is a relic of your 16-year-old self trying to avoid criticism and it's holding back your 40-year-old goals, asking, is this moving me forward, forces that necessary confrontation. If the only answer is, well, it's easy, you found a piece of the programming.
It challenges the deep-seated notion that if something is comfortable, it must be safe. Often the most uncomfortable actions, that difficult conversation, that risky career application, that new exercise regime, are the ones that yield the highest utility.
Moving on to the fourth question, which is critical for exposing intentionality. Do my actions reflect my goals or my fears?
This is perhaps the most powerful diagnostic tool against the emotional firewall. It forces you to look at the motive behind the action or the inaction. The program is fundamentally built on self-protection and preservation of the status quo, meaning it operates primarily from fear and risk avoidance.
Whereas a conscious, self-authored life operates from intention and goal alignment.
Exactly.
So we need to find the line between programmed fear and just healthy prudence. How does this question help distinguish between the two?
Healthy Prudence asks, what specific resources do I need to acquire to execute this goal safely? It's analytical and it moves toward action.
It's constructive.
It's constructive. Programmed Fear asks, what is the worst possible outcome and how can I avoid taking action at all? It is paralyzing and it moves toward inaction.
Let's apply that to a creative goal, like launching a side business or writing a book.
Okay. If your actions reflect your fear, you will spend months perfecting the website, endlessly researching competitors, and obsessing over minor details, never actually launching the minimal viable product. The procrastination is the action, and the motive is fear of failure or judgment.
And if your actions reflect your goal,
you launch the imperfect thing, you gather data, you iterate, you move forward despite the fear, because the goal is more compelling than the comfort of avoiding risk.
This question clearly exposes when you are operating from a place of defensive reaction, avoiding that metaphorical electric fence, rather than conscious offensive intention.
It helps you to see yourself as either a defensive reactor or an offensive creator. The answer reveals the true master of the action.
And this is so crucial because the programming is almost entirely defensive.
Yes. True freedom means choosing a goal and letting intention drive your action, allowing the fear to come along for the ride without letting it steer the bus.
And the final crowbar, which is designed for creating separation. Is this rule part of my identity or just part of my past?
This is the permission question. It is vital for deactivation. After you've traced the source, assessed the motive, and tested the utility, you need permission. Psychological permission to let the old pattern go.
Because the programming, remember, was carefully sculpted into a perceived personality during phase three.
It was.
So if I have been running the rule, I must always be the responsible one in the room, that rule is now intertwined with the identity. I am a responsible person.
And challenging the rule feels like challenging your self-worth.
Exactly.
This question creates a cognitive wedge. It forces the separation between a long-held habit, which is just data from the past, and the core self, the essence of who you are now, the conscious, intentional adult.
So if the rule is revealed to be merely a historical artifact, a defense mechanism you needed at age 12 but no longer need, it's no longer bound to your current identity.
Correct. Can I provide another example of that separation?
Please.
Consider someone who refuses to delegate tasks at work because they believe if I don't do it perfectly, it won't be done right. They've internalized this rule as, I am a reliable perfectionist.
Okay.
By asking this crowbar question, they can separate the rule from the self. The core identity is, I am capable and I care about quality. But the rule of non-delegation is just a conditioned habit from a past environment where they were unsupported.
And once that separation is achieved, the rule or belief is demoted from who I am to something I used to do.
And that grants the individual the crucial psychological permission to let it go without feeling like they are sacrificing their fundamental self.
They can remain a capable person while changing the limiting outdated rule.
That's the powerful framework. Five precision questions, each designed to dismantle a specific pillar of the programming, forcing awareness where there was once only automaticity.
The synthesis here is key, though. This isn't a one-time process, is it? It's an ongoing discipline.
It is. Consistent, rigorous use of these five questions forces the programming to unravel itself by constantly confronting the contradictions between conditioned behavior and authentic desire. You are systematically auditing the code base and forcing the system to reveal its limitations.
It's an active process of constant self-query.
That is the definitive path to a self-authored life.
Because the programming can handle passive acceptance, it can handle vague dissatisfaction, but it cannot withstand relentless, targeted questioning.
Logic and consciousness are the antivirus for this invisible OS. The system was installed unconsciously, but it must be uninstalled consciously, one question at a time.
We've reached the conclusion of this deep dive, and let's just try to summarize the powerful shift we've defined today.
Okay.
Societal programming is, at its core, an inherited script of unchosen rules and beliefs. It defines your normal, it shapes your automatic reactions, and most importantly, it operates just below the level of conscious awareness.
And it's protected by that emotional firewall of fear, guilt, and shame.
Right. We detailed how this script gets installed across three critical phases. First, through that hypnotic absorption in childhood, then through behavioral enforcement in our school years, and finally, it's cemented into identity itself in our teens and early 20s.
And understanding that installation is so critical because it shows you that these limitations are learned. They are not inherent to who you are.
And the process of dismantling it is clear.
Hmm.
It requires observing the programming through those five signs, questioning its origins with the mental crowbars, and consciously challenging its outdated rules.
It's not about suddenly becoming a perfect superhuman version of yourself.
No.
It's about changing your relationship to the world's expectations.
The shift is profound.
Yeah.
You move from being a character running someone else's code, basically a passenger in your own life, to becoming the author, the programmer of your own reality.
And this allows for those small acts of micro-rebellion that the source material mentions, those small acts that incrementally reclaim your personal autonomy.
Can we ground those micro-rebellions in the practical? What does that look like on a Monday morning?
It could be choosing to decline a social obligation that feels mandatory simply because you need the time for yourself. That's challenging the guilt firewall.
Okay.
It could be buying a brand or wearing a style outside of what you know your peer group would approve of, challenging the outsourced identity.
Right.
Or, perhaps most profoundly, it could be taking a different, longer route to work just to break the routine and force consciousness into the autopilot behavior. Every single time you ask a crowbar question and act on the authentic answer, you are performing a micro-rebellion.
And that small act of deviation breaks the compliance pattern. It weakens the emotional firewall, and it shows you that the pain of the conditioned response is temporary.
But the reward of autonomy is permanent.
So if we connect this to the bigger picture, the implication of this freedom is enormous, isn't it?
It is. The programming loses its grip when you choose to act in alignment with your conscious goals rather than your conditioned fears. When your internal authority, that quiet, authentic compass you now rely on, becomes louder than the world's input, the GPS.
The spell is broken.
The spell is broken.
What happens then? What is the final state of being when the script is fully edited?
The final provocation, the ultimate implication of fully questioning and dismantling this inherited script is this.
Oh.
You become uncontrollable.
Uncontrolled.
A self-directed being.
A threat to the default human OS.
Precisely. Because a person whose actions are governed by internal intention rather than external conditioning cannot be reliably predicted or manipulated by the system that trained them. They are no longer compliant. They cannot be reliably motivated by fear, guilt, or shame because they've mapped the electric fence and disabled the current.
And therefore?
They are fundamentally free.
The journey to freedom, then, starts with a single crucial question. What rule are you following right now that isn't even yours? Go edit your OS.